We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Well, if you visit Allerton Park, you may find yourself wondering, am I in East Central Illinois? There are formal walled gardens, a mansion with a reflecting pool. There are paths to wander and sculptures to discover. Located in Piatt County, Allerton Park has been designated one of the seven wonders of Illinois. This afternoon, we'll look into the life of the man who donated the estate to the University of Illinois in 1946, Robert Allerton. Our guests this afternoon are Martha Bergen and Maureen Holtz. They are co-authors of Robert Allerton, The Private Man and the Public Gifts. Questions and comments for our guests this afternoon are invited. Listeners, we look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Marty Bergen retired from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School at Dallas as a biomedical graphic designer in 2002 and returned to her hometown of Monticello. She is the illustrator of several medical textbooks. Maureen Holtz and her husband moved to Monticello in 1991. She retired from the computer industry in 2004 and is now pursuing her interest in writing. Their book, Robert Allerton, The Private Man and the Public Gifts, is published by the News Gazette. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Welcome. Good to have you here. Well,
thanks for having us.
Question for both of you, each of you. When was your first visit to Allerton Park?
Marty, you want
to
go first?
I beat Maureen. Yeah, I grew up in Monticello, so I remember being too small to walk and Dad carrying me, so I must have been pretty little.
Yeah, and Maureen?
Well, I went to college here, and truthfully, I only came out once because a friend had a car and remembered it. And then when I moved here in 1991, one of the top things about living here was the ability to be able to go out to Allerton Park whenever you wanted and walk. And so we started spending weekends wandering around and getting to know the place.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite place within the park?
Marty?
All of it.
Yeah.
You know, all of it.
It depends. Sometimes, I love the food dogs this morning. I love the food dogs, and I love the centaur. Those are, like, my two favorite areas of art. I also love the meadow on a beautiful sunny day. The lit mansion at sunset, it's beautiful. So there's a lot to be said for everything.
So how were the two of you introduced, and how did you come to write this book together?
A mutual friend introduced the two of us at an event because we were both writing other projects, and that person thought we should meet. And we met a couple of times to talk with each other about our separate projects and decided that we both had this one in the back of our minds, so we decided to tackle it.
Yeah, and when was that?
Summer of 2007.
Right. We were talking about how, you know, the definitive book on Robert Allerton needs to be written and why hasn't it been written. And then we thought, well, why don't we write it? We're writers.
Yeah. Why hadn't it been written?
Well, there was a book that's out there and it's called Majestic Allerton. And it's a nice 28-page book that I think the foundation put together in a hurry for a particular reason. I can't remember exactly the reason. And it was a good start, but there's no footnotes, et cetera, and we wanted to really dig. And actually, we thought we could put something together in 6 months and away we'd go. And then the more we dug, the more we found, and the more we found, the more we needed to dig. And once you discover the archived newspapers online, it opens up a whole new world.
Yeah. Well, Robert Allerton was, as it is indicated in your title, a private man. What challenges did you face as his biographers, Marty?
He left very little behind about his own life. So we think it was like triangulating. We had to work our way from the outside in many cases through biographies of people that he was associated with and through descendants of his friends and associates. So we would find about Robert from other sources until we could piece together a puzzle that started to bring him back to life.
Mm-hmm. What were your richest resources, your richest sources?
Well, the Madam X on the who was a society columnist in the Tribune in the 1900s wrote prolifically about Robert. We believe she must have had a crush on Robert, even though she was a little older, but you know, who cares? That was very useful. The archive newspapers were fabulous. We read about the scandal of his sister's cad of a husband. And then once we found his great-grandnephew, we were able to get some information about his about Robert's sister and her family, and that kind of fleshed out a little bit. And then as Marty was saying, descendants of other people. A real coup for me was many people, when they go out to the park, they may have been inside the Butternut Room, and there's a portrait of Robert that was painted by this woman named Ellen Emmett, who was a prolific painter in her day, supposedly on the same fame as Mary Cassatt, one of the top painters in her time, and he was supposedly in love with her. Well, I got in touch with her granddaughter, and the granddaughter said, "I've got these letters that Robert wrote. Ellen, y'all want them?" And of course, I couldn't say yes fast enough, and that finally gave us something in Robert's handwriting and Robert's angst and Robert's feelings, because very little that showed his feelings, very little writings exist that show his feelings. And this was something.
Yeah. This was very curious. At various points in his life, he destroyed what he had made or what had been handed to him.
Yes, he did.
Marty, you're nodding. Tell us, tell us about this.
Well, the first real clear example of that was he studied art in Europe with his friend Frederick Clay Bartlett. Bartlett went on to be a very successful muralist in Chicago. But Robert decided he didn't have the talent. And although he had been accepted to the Royal Academy in Munich, which was quite a coup, and then proceeded to study in Paris for a while, he suddenly destroyed his paintings and said, "That's it. I'm going home," and ended up building the mansion in Monticello.
Yeah,
but it's been very curious to me because my background, my degree's in painting. I know what that is to destroy your paintings. I'm thinking, what happened? And nobody's ever said anything about, you know, why would he do that? And we still don't have a definitive answer. But when you read about his relationship with Frederick and his degree of talent, which, you know, he may have genuinely decided that he really didn't have the talent, but it just seemed a sudden explosive act.
Yeah. Well, when his stepmother died, he destroyed a lot of the property that she left him in her will, although they were very much like mother and son,
mm-hmm.
son
right,
and
right.
mother.
Right.
They were very fond of one another. They loved
right.
one another. But he
threw the silver off the end of the pier.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the stories we heard was that, well, he had enough silver. He didn't need any more silver. Actually, we found the silver for sale on the Internet recently. It was on Replacements Limited or something like that. It had her initials on it, AA, for Agnes Allerton, and they were asking $100,000. And we were like, ooh, you know, can the Art Institute buy it or something like that? But, yeah. I just think in many ways he wasn't sentimental. My father burnt a lot of stuff after my mother died and after his parents died. So that's what made me think that maybe it was, you know, just a different approach to didn't want anybody to have their hands on the stuff, and he didn't have any need for it, and this is what he was going to do with it.
Yeah. You mentioned he was often found within the pages of the Chicago Tribune, he and his family. And the first chapter of the book begins with a look back to a story that appeared in the Trib in 1906. And he was the subject. You want to tell us about the article?
Yeah, Lauren? There was in February of 1906, the Sunday special feature section, the entire page and several pages thereafter, are dedicated to Robert. The front page of the feature section has a picture of Robert, which is essentially the same sort of picture that we've got on the cover of our book. And you have all these Gibson girls in their long dresses blowing kisses at him. Our conjecture is that, his father, Samuel, was good friends. Their entire family was good friends with the McCormick family, who owned the Tribune. So we figured Daddy called up Colonel McCormick and said, my son's 33. He's not married. Do what you can. And this was probably what they did. It's not identified as a Madam X column, but it sure sounds like Madam X from all the other columns that I've read. And it's quite gushy.
Yeah. Now, how did he feel being this private guy? How does he feel about having himself splashed across the pages of the Chicago Tribune?
Well, he was very young when that article came out, and I think he took it all in his stride. I think later in life, after he built the mansion down here and had his own private playground, he became much more private. But he was really, in many ways, two different men. In Chicago, he was very much in the middle of the group of citizens who brought Chicago into the cultural scene in the early part of the century, very socially active with those people. And he brought many of them down to the farms to entertain them here. I think our impression of him as being a private man comes from being from Monticello, where he clearly kept his distance from the townspeople, except for the few relatives and friends that he had in Monticello. He was also quite active with the university. So he kind of had two different personalities that he used to his benefit.
And I think it's very telling that if you think, oh my God, they're writing about me. I'm 33 years old. They're trying to sell me to the highest bidding woman or something. And then they did something very similar the next year. Yet when Madame X died, he was one of the official pallbearers at her funeral, and she came down to visit the park on a number of occasions, and she'd write about it. So I think he just accepted it as this is part of noblesse oblige, you know, the role that he filled as Chicago's richest bachelor, the son of the third richest man in Chicago, and this is what he had to do, and it is what it was.
And we also have to keep in mind that he was severely hearing impaired from the age of 7. And I think in many ways it's hard to know how much of his personality was shaped by that and how much was just his personality. But he did prefer small groups of people. And communication for him was difficult.
And also his mother passed away
yes.
when he was only 7 years old.
Right, mm-hmm. right. After they all contracted scarlet fever and she died and his sister and he were severely impaired for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Father and son are two very different men.
Absolutely.
Sam Ellerton. Hogg.
Hogg Ellerton.
Where did the money come from, and what was Sam like?
Sam was very plain spoken. He was brought himself up by the bootstraps, and he essentially cornered the hog market during the Civil War. He was one of the founders of the Chicago Stockyards and the First National Bank of Chicago. And so by the time Robert came along in 1873, he had made his fortune. They lived on Prairie Avenue across from the fields and the rest of the Prairie Avenue elite. And Ethelfield, in fact, was one of Robert's early playmates. So that's essentially how he made his fortune. He owned farmland all the way from the East Coast to Nebraska. So Robert really could have lived anywhere he chose, but he chose Monticello.
Yeah. Why Monticello? Why Piatt County?
Because it's beautiful, and he knew it.
And well, when Robert was seven, Samuel gave him, I believe it was 280 acres in Piatt County. Not that that was enough for his little kingdom, but it is some of the richest farmland in the United States. They would bring the cattle and all the animals up from Nebraska, and they would stop in Piatt County and get them fattened up. And then they'd get them on the railroad, I believe, and then ship them up to Chicago. And there was an article I read somewhere saying for every hog or beef that's shipped on the railroad, Sam Ellerton becomes rich again. He had his hands in railroads and everything. I mean, Sam was an intelligent man who knew how to be there at the right time.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about Robert Ellerton. Our guests are his biographers, Maureen Holtz and Martha Bergen. They are the authors of Robert Ellerton, The Private Man and the Public Gifts. Robert Ellerton gave a lot of his fortune away to the arts in Chicago, to the University of Illinois. We'll talk a little bit later about his gift to the people of Hawaii. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Maureen, earlier you mentioned Ellen Emmett, an important figure in his life. You told us a little bit about her. She was a talented painter. They had a courtship and quite the correspondence.
Right. We never knew quite exactly when he met her. Some people thought maybe it was while he was in Europe studying in the late early 1890s. But everything kind of points to the fact that he probably met her around 1898, something like that, possibly in New York City, where she had already set up a studio in Washington Square. He lived in Washington Square area for a while after he came back from Europe. All his friends were getting married, and he was kind of at loose ends and didn't know what to do with himself. Could be that he met her through Frederick, his best buddy, or through other people. We do know that they had their circle of friends just kind of moved like an amoeba. Her second cousin was Henry James, and he was friends with Henry James. And one of the more intriguing things was to find letters. The Emmett family, I'm digressing for a second, but she had several sisters and some cousins, and they were all involved in the arts, and they all were mostly painters. And she supported most of them because they weren't as prolific and as lucky as she was, too. But there's these letters that the Emmett family gave to the Smithsonian. And you can get those out on interlibrary loan. And one letter from one of the cousins said, Henry James. They always called him Henry James, not just Henry. Henry James thinks that Robert's going to marry Ellen. And then another letter says, it's a shame that Ellen's mother won't let Robert marry Ellen. So there was obviously a relationship that was considered very deep. And then the letters that we have are from about a six-month period where he progresses from Dear Miss Emmett to Dear Ellen, and then All My Love and that sort of stuff. So there was something, I think, pining. I think he was vulnerable. I think he was lonely. I think they had a lot in common. But I think in the long run, she wanted to be out east, and he didn't.
Yeah.
So
she became engaged to another man.
Yes, mm-hmm. 12 years younger. But as her granddaughter said, the thing with Ellen was that she liked a handsome face. She wanted someone who had lots of money, and she wanted a farm and horses. And I said, well, Robert filled the bill. But, of course, this isn't New York City.
Yeah. And she also seems to me, she strikes me, I don't know, Marty, as a very independent woman.
Extremely independent.
Uh-huh. I don't know if
yes.
her biography's been written. But
for her to become a successful portrait artist at that time was extraordinary. And she did have an extraordinary talent. She was studied with McMonies and shared a studio at one point with Sargent. She was a good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's. Eleanor used to like to come to Ellen's studio to unwind from the social pressures. And she did Franklin Roosevelt's official portrait. So, yeah, she was very independent and driven and remained so her whole life. She was prolific.
I think of Katharine Hepburn years. When I think of her. You know, that's the image that I get. When
but
I...
not in looks.
Well, maybe not. Red hair. She had red hair. But, oh, well. I'll save that for next.
What do you say we take a call?
Okay.
From a listener.
Okay.
We've got a listener waiting for us in Hoopston on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello. I had a question. I heard you mention the food dogs earlier. And my question is, in 1974, I visited the park, and I saw a statue out there of an Indian and a bear locked in mortal combat. Indian sword was driven into the bear, and the bear had his claws ripping the Indian apart, and on the Indian's belt was the bear cub dead, and they were locked in mortal combat. Recently, my 18-year-old daughter went and visited the park to seek out this statue, but was told it was no longer there, and I was wondering about the history of the statue, if you knew anything about it, and where it had went. And I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Yes. There were two statues by Fremier, who was noted for his anatomical sculptures of animals and humans. But both of those sculptures were acquired by the university after the park was donated. Robert had nothing to do with their acquisition. And, in fact, John Gregg, Robert's adopted son, was disapproving of them having been placed in the park. Eventually, they found a home at Krannert, at the Krannert Museum on campus. And so everybody's happy. They found a good home. Actually, I thought it was always kind of amusing because where they were placed out in the wilderness, you would come up on them quite by surprise. So,
but if you do want to see them, by all means, go to the Krannert Art Museum. They're there.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Questions, comments for our guests are invited this afternoon. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guests are Maureen Holtz and Martha Bergen, co-authors of Robert Allerton, The Private Man and the Public Gifts. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, he had been a painter, so he was interested in the arts, but how did that begin? What led him to painting, mm-hmm. which he actually then later abandoned?
His stepmother, Agnes, who was also his aunt, by the way, Agnes was his mother's younger sister, was very tuned into the arts and mentored him in that direction. He also loved music, loved the opera, even in spite of being hearing impaired. He started drawing. We found some drawings of, it looked like opera singers or people attending the opera in costume when he was young, in the margin of his spelling book. And he had some talent, took a few classes at the Art Institute. And I think Frederick Clay Bartlett's interest in art inspired him to want to study. His father certainly had no interest in the arts and only grudgingly allowed him to go to Europe to study.
After the Columbian Exhibition.
He was greatly inspired by the Columbian Exhibition of 1893, where there were huge displays of art. It was his first. He and Frederick were both overwhelmed by it and decided right then and there that they would go to Europe to study art.
Mm-hmm. Of course, drinking prodigious amounts of German wine helped.
Yes, helped greatly.
So he comes home and he decides he's not a painter. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have the talent. So he and his father determined that the farms would be the place for him to manage the farms.
And there are two different accounts of that. One makes it seem more Robert's idea and one makes it seem more his father's. But apparently they were in agreement enough that they decided that was the way to go. And, of course, his father said, take that young boy with you and go off to Europe and study country homes and find out what you would like to build. John Borey was the architect for the mansion, who was a young architect about Robert's age who was related into the Ryerson family of Chicago. He came from a very well-established East Coast family. And it was one of the few buildings that he actually designed. He was mostly a designer of gargoyles for other buildings. And so the fact that his father had permitted him to build a beautiful mansion on the land, I'm sure, helped seal the deal.
You know, in the book, early in the book, you pose this question. Was it only a concession to his father, or was he consciously inspired by the juxtaposition of the rustic and the refined? So here he moves into this beautiful home, the mansion, in 1901, and then he begins to work the land in terms of designing and establishing these formal gardens.
Mm-hmm. He was an interesting combination of his heritage. I think he genuinely appreciated the art of farming. I think he got that from his father and respected that in his father's past. And considered himself to be a great steward of the land. He managed the farms very successfully, well, mostly successfully, had a few bad years, but he loved the land. He loved that particular piece of land by the river. But he chose landscape architecture as a different way to express his own personality. And a lot of the work that we see in the gardens are pieces that he was personally attracted to, or they were from artists that he had met and chose to sponsor and help further their careers. He was a great patron to individual artists as well as in general to the Art Institute. So, of course, most of the good work went to the Art Institute, but what you see at Allerton Park is what he personally enjoyed having around him.
Yeah, this Maureen, I was a little surprised at about his involvement with the farms because I wasn't sure if he was a gentleman farmer or if he actually did get involved. And an early letter in 1901 to Ellen, he says he's not sure he can come to New York City to see her because the crops are doing so well. He wasn't sure if he even had the money to go, and I was kind of shocked at that. And so obviously he was trying to not get money from his father. But of course then in 1914, which was 14 years after this, when Robert was well into managing the land, there's letters that I've seen in the U of I archives from Sam, his father, who was now in his 80s, telling Robert's farm manager which tenant farmer no longer was doing the right job, et cetera. So it sounds like Sam was still kind of taking a lot of involvement.
So Sam was had a hand in.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, seriously.
We've got a number of callers.
Yeah, I can see that.
Phone lines are lighting up. So let's go and take a call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, three questions. The easy one. I haven't seen this book. I guess it just came out. But one of the authors is from Monticello, grew up in Monticello, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's me. This is Marty.
Okay. The other question is a little more difficult. I'd like to put this delicately. There's two rumors about Mr. Allerton. One is that he was, oriented at that time towards the love that dare not speak its name.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
That is true.
Well, everything pretty much points that direction. He was very circumspect. The people that knew Robert and John Gregg said everybody knew about them, but what did it matter?
Right.
And I think that's the one of the big reasons why he decided to spend the years from 1938 onward in Kauai, where he could be a little bit, they could be a little bit more freer with their lives.
Okay. And the other rumor is that he imported rattlesnakes.
Those are the two things that everybody always wants to know.
Yeah, now we've had the two questions that everyone asks.
Yes. Marty, you want to address that one?
Well,
I'll hang up and...
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, there were snakes. No, he did not import them. And I remember my history teacher in school telling me that he was there when the crates of rattlesnakes came in on the railroad cars. And it was just a myth. The snakes that are there naturally, but they were prolific and they were all over the place. Robert's comment to that was, why would I bring snakes in on my own land? I'm the one who's out there walking around in them. You know, he was very protective of them and didn't like to see them harmed.
Right. There were the river Massasauga, is my understanding, and they're kind of shy creatures, and they like to hang out in the swampy areas at the base of the trees. And they've died off a lot, but they're still, from looking at actually some newspaper articles I've read by Rob Cantor and other people and the Department of Natural Resources, they're tracking them. And there's little baby rattlesnakes roaming around there, but they were like hanging from the trees and getting into people's houses back at the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. They were all over.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
It's a shame that, let me back up. I assume Mr. Allerton was aware of the work of Frank Lloyd Wright, being from the Chicago area, and at that, you know, the Wright was in his prime, early prime anyway, between 1890 and 1908, so forth. And, did you find any mention in his memoirs, any mention of his work, or if they ever met? And I often wonder how, okay, if you like the style of the Allerton House, fine. I'm more of a fan of Frank Lloyd Wright. And it sounds like they both shared a great love of nature, which was another thing that, another characteristic of Wright, what Allerton Park would be like if Frank Lloyd Wright had managed to get the commission instead of whoever it was that did otherwise. If you know anything about he and Mr. Wright, please say so, and if there was nothing, well, I guess there was nothing. Thank you.
We don't have any direct evidence that they met. However, they may have met in Chicago through the Arts Club of Chicago or through other social events in Chicago. There's no evidence that he ever visited the park. And it is a very interesting question. The design of the mansion was rather typical of its time. In fact, David Adler designed a house out east for some friends of Robert's that's very similar to the Allerton Mansion, but it was several years later. It would have been interesting to know. I don't see in Robert Allerton's creations much of the Wright influence, but that's not to say they didn't meet or to say that he didn't admire Wright's work.
Right, in the book, when we did some of the research on the Arts Club, which he belonged to, and the Cliff Dwellers Club, which he belonged to, I'm pretty sure that Frank Lloyd Wright belonged to the Arts Club and may have belonged to the Cliff Dwellers. I can't remember right now.
He may have been like an associate member,
right,
or something,
right,
at the time.
Right.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Belgium. Line 4, hi.
Hello. I'd like to discuss the actual layout of Allerton Park. I've been led to believe that when Robert started out there, the actual Sangamon River area there was pretty much denuded of trees, and he really replanted that forest?
Yeah, when he built the mansion, he could see water from every direction, and the river, you could see the river clearly from the house. That's at least from our notes, from what we discovered. And I think a lot of that forest has grown up naturally, but it was very open land when he built the mansion, and you can see that in the early photographs.
So he didn't actually promulgate the forest. It just naturally grew back up.
I believe it naturally grew up.
I see.
You could actually see the food, where the food dogs are now. You could see that area from the house. It's amazing, these early photographs, how open it was compared to what it is now.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. And along those lines, tell us the story of the sunken garden.
It used to be the garbage dump for the house. He built the formal gardens pretty much in a string, all the way from... Well, there's a beautiful winding path to the first of the gardens, the brick wall garden. And then the gardens proceed like railroad cars all the way to the sunken garden. And then on to through a wooded area to the centaur, and then the furthest one out being the Sunsinger. I forgot the question. The sunken garden really has gone through a lot of redesigns and...
Mostly with John.
With John. The terrain was lower there. It had been, and so they just decided to keep digging and make it a sunken garden. It was inspired by his trips to Asia, and then took a little bit of an Art Nouveau twist later in years. But originally, there were two wooden gazebos at each end. So and the food dogs were located in the lower level. So.
Yeah, a lot of the statuary has moved like it had its own feet because Robert didn't like to keep things in the same place, and then he'd build a new garden and say, well, let's move the Three Graces over here or whatever. Mm-hmm. He moved things around.
Actually, the Chinese musicians were not in the position where we see them today until after Robert died.
Right. And the girl with the scarf, he didn't buy that until 1942, and he was already living in Kauai then. So, yeah, He did things on behalf of the gardens even when he wasn't necessarily going to be there long term.
Other questions, comments about Robert Allerton are invited this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free 800-222-9455.
You know, so last I was going to bring up one thing you mentioned a little while ago about Ellen Emmett, and, you know, there's not much about her. Actually, her granddaughter has just written a book. It's a lovely book. It's called Dear Females, because that was how Ellen would write these prodigious letters to her cousins and her sisters, all living. They all were, you know, living hand to mouth in Paris at one point, and she'd write a letter saying Dear Females to them. And it's just a wonderful treasure of a book. I think you could probably find it if you Google Dear Females or Ellen Emmett Rand, who's the granddaughter.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about John Wyatt Gregg, who we've really only mentioned in passing. Who was he? When did they meet? How did their relationship evolve?
They met in 1922. John Gregg was an architecture student at the U of I, and they met at a Dad's Day dinner,
well,
at a luncheon.
Actually, they met before then.
Well, yeah.
They met before then.
John Gregg's roommate was from Monticello, and they were the roommate was related to Allerton's mother's family. I'll let Maureen talk about this. She's better with names and dates.
I'm the social organizer on this. Robert's roommate, or John's roommate, excuse me, I believe was Aisler Dighton, and Robert's was related to the Dighton family through his mother and his aunt. And the Dightons lived in Monticello. So John's parents were dead by then, and periodically the roommate would say, come on, let's go to Monticello. And, you know, they'd go and they'd run into Robert, or they'd go over to the Allerton Park and or the farms, as Robert called it, and visit Robert. And there was a Dad's Day lunch coming up, and at the fraternity where they lived, and John didn't have a dad, and so Aisler suggested to his father, William Dighton, well, why don't you bring Robert along so that John can have a dad here? And Robert had been involved with the Campus Plan Commission, which helped organize the Memorial Stadium, decide where it went, and help organize the plan for the quad, et cetera. So Robert was very involved with a lot of things for the U of I at that point. And they just kind of fell into a great habit of being together as a father and son as a result of that Dad's Day dinner. But they had known each other before. This just kind of solidified things.
Yeah, and the evolution of their relationship?
It took on many dimensions. Robert always introduced John as his son. John called Robert his father always. And I think there was a strong element of father-son relationship. Robert was his mentor, in some ways, his employer. You know, there was no question about who was the boss.
actually, in letters that John wrote in the 40s from Hawaii, he would write to the bookkeeper in Chicago. He'd call the boss. The boss says this and the boss says that. He never, every now and then he'd say Robert or my father, but most of the time it was the boss.
Hmm. Were they lovers?
Everything points that way, yeah. Someone in Hawaii said that they had seen Robert and John together one time, and I didn't think it useful to put that in the book because it just kind of makes sense that they were, and everybody thinks and knows that they were, but why turn it into something that sounds kind of tawdry?
Yeah, and you very gently take readers in that direction through examining some other relationships in his life that were important to him.
Right.
So let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been enjoying the book for 2 days.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. Glad to hear it.
Yes, I was wondering if there during the Harlem Renaissance and in their travels to Africa and the Mediterranean and all over, did they sponsor any Negro artists?
I don't know that they did. However, Glenn Philpott, who was the sculptor of the Primitive Men, at least he designed the maquette from which the Primitive Men was built, was involved in that very much. So in his work,
Okay. Yeah,
but that was later in Philpott's life.
Yeah. Well, the characters are all interesting. I want to follow up on these other people in the book, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an interesting biography of Glenn Philpott, then, that might interest you.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, tell us now a little bit about this wonderful place in Hawaii that was also made a gift.
Well, he found the place in 1938. He and Robert and John were on their way back from Australia. They always came back from their winter trips because they hated Illinois winters. And a friend had said, oh, you've got to see this place on Kauai. And they were staying in Honolulu, but they didn't have a place to stay one night. So they decided to take this kind of plane, hovercraft or whatever it was, to Kauai and visit the premises, and they fell in love with it, and they offered, once they got back to Illinois, they decided, yeah, they had to have it, because by this time, Robert was 64 years old, and I think he was giving some real thought as to, well, every winter we're going someplace new, maybe we should have a new base that we don't have to necessarily veer from too often. Plus, I think he was prescient enough to realize that there's a lot of conflict going on in some of the places that he really liked to go to, and maybe this would keep him away from those places. And so they bought 80 acres for $50,000 in 1938 and started making it their little paradise.
Hmm. And Robert Allerton passed away long before John George. George lived...
Greg
lived another couple of decades.
Right.
What were those years like for him?
For John?
Yeah.
Well, actually, from everything I hear, he was living quite the style. By the time... I don't want to give John a bad image or anything like that, but I think he liked to party a little bit more. He had some fun on the island before Robert died, and then after Robert died. There were a lot of movies being made in that area, too. So they were entertaining movie stars and even Richard Nixon, John Wayne, Jackie Onassis, et cetera. So they liked their privacy. John came back still every May, and he went on trips with other people. So I don't think John was lonely.
Mm-hmm. And he also carried on Robert's philanthropies. He changed his name to Allerton in order to do that more easily. And he wanted the name to be recognized as Allerton.
As opposed
to John Gregg.
I can give you about 30 seconds here, maybe a little bit longer, but what led to the impulse to be so generous?
For him? I think it was brought out in him by his stepmother, Agnes, and his father. It was just part of what you did and the circle that he revolved in. And he wanted to help promote the idea of botanical gardens in Kauai and art everywhere.
And his other philanthropies to medical institutions, it wasn't just limited to art.
Right, so. Nursing association, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There we have to wrap it up. We're out of time. It's been delightful talking with the two of you.
Thank you. I can't believe how fast it's gone.
and reading the book, Robert Allerton, The Private Man and the Public Gifts. The authors, co-authors of the book, have been our guests in this portion of the afternoon magazine, Marty Bergen and Maureen Holt. Their book, Robert Allerton, The Private Man and the Public Gifts, is published by the News Gazette. And coming up Saturday on Dad's Day, you're going to do a book signing?
Yeah, we're at the Illini Union from 3 to 4 on Saturday. We have things scheduled throughout the months. If you... look at the website. We have a cheap little website at sites, google.com, site Allerton Book, and we have all of our listings there. And the News Gazette's been publicizing it generously as we get our signings.
Okay, so we'll keep an eye out.
Thank you.
Okay.